Good morning, everybody. I want to commemorate an anniversary. That's why this page from Wikipedia is up. How many of you have never used Wikipedia? Two of you. All right. Okay. No. I'm taking polls because that number is constantly changing. If I do that poll again in another 6 months, arguably no hands will go up. All right. 2,050 years ago today, Caesar got it. All right. 44 BC, not 2006 AD. It's 2,050 years ago today that Caesar bought it. Just so we're clear. That's going to be a frame for my talk today. I figured I might as well take advantage of the occasion. All right. I need to do a little bit of a survey. How many of you are over 21? Oh, my God. Now you're just blown my entire theory to crap, but it's all right. We're gonna recover gracefully and move on from here. How many of you are over 25? Okay, you two don't count your instructors. All right. So most of you are under 25. What I want to start off talking about is expectations and how expectations with relation to technological devices change over time. Now, right now, the web is, at least in popular culture, it's 12 years old. So for those of you who are under, say, 21, that means you were about 9, 8 when the web came out. I was 31 when the web came out, which means my experience of the web and of what computers do is a little bit different than yours, because if you think about it, when you sit down at a computer today, whether it's a laptop or a desktop machine, your experience of what you're going to do with that computer is generally conditioned by the fact that while you're on that computer, at some time while you're using that computer, you're going to use the web, right? Maybe that's the only thing that you do with that computer when you sit down in front of it. But before 1994, there was no web, and so people did other things with computers. Now, what the hell did they do with computers before there was the web? Have you ever asked yourself that question? Keeping in mind that people didn't really use email much before the web either. I mean, they did kind of, maybe within a company, but you didn't send email around the world the way you do today. So have you thought about what people did with computers before there was a web? So it's an odd question, isn't it? Because you don't think about a computer except thinking about it as something that runs the web. Well, there was a time before the web, and before the web, people did two things classically with computers. They ran spreadsheets on computers, and they ran word processing programs on computers. And back when I started using computers, actually slightly after I started using computers, there were two big programs that everyone used on computers, and one of them was called VisiCalc. VisiCalc was the first spreadsheet program. You're all familiar with Microsoft Excel, because that's the spreadsheet that basically everyone uses these days. And VisiCalc was the first spreadsheet program. And VisiCalc was very interesting because, you know, it ran on a little Apple II computer, this very sort of old-fashioned computer. And before VisiCalc, there was no reason for most people to own a computer. Now, computers had been around for 3-4 years. At least small computers, home computers had been around for 3 or 4 years before VisiCalc came out. And they were bought by hobbyists who would sit there and maybe write little programs for them and maybe write little games for them. And that was about all they'd do with them, because that was really all people sort of wanted to do, thought you could do with them. And then VisiCalc comes out, and all of a sudden, all these financial people and business people are using computers to do financial modeling on, because you can use a spreadsheet very flexibly to do all sorts of financial modeling that you can't really do on a piece of paper. People used to do them on pieces of paper, and in fact what they would do is they would go into rooms that were covered with chalkboards and with lots of squares on the chalkboards, and would actually work out the same thing that a spreadsheet does laboriously on square after square of a chalkboard, but it was just too much work, so people didn't do it. So you have this the personal computer, the Apple. And it was for people to play with. And then, all of a sudden, VisiCalc comes out, and it redefines what people do with a computer, and VisiCalc is single-handedly responsible for making the personal computer a commonplace device because it was so important that it changed the definition of what that device was for. All right, same thing with word processing. And so that was, you know, very nice, tootling along the revolution until 1994-ish, really a little bit earlier, but by the time it came into popular consciousness, 1994, that's the computer that the World Wide Web was invented on. It's getting a little long in the tooth these days. And when the World Wide Web came out, there was a period of about 18 months from, let's say, March of 1994 through around September of 1995, when essentially there was a giant sucking sound, and everything that was in the world got sucked into the web over that period of time. And if you go back and look at the news stories, the articles, and all the stuff that's going on at this time, people feel like they've found a new continent. It was like discovering the new world, and people were experimenting and playing and doing all these interesting things, and it seemed for a while that everything was unbounded, that anything was possible. And in that period of time, the conception of what a computer was, what a computer did, what a computer could be used for, was entirely changed. And for 95% of all of you in this class, you don't remember the before time. You don't remember what it was like to use a computer without a web browser on it. Am I basically right there? So your experience of your expectations when you sit in front of the computer date from a period after the emergence of the web. So the applications that we invent for our technology, not the technology itself, but the way we decide we're going to use that technology, that actually determines how we think about that technology. If the web had not been invented, or was invented this year rather than, say, 1991, your experience of what a computer would be used for yourselves in uni, would be something that you typed your papers up on. It would be a word processing device. All right. But because we exist in this time, after the invention of the web, when you sit down in front of it, yeah, you can type your paper up on it, but more likely what you're going to do is you're going to do your research, you're maybe going to IM your friends, you're going to send email, you're going to do all these other different things that have to do with the fact that the computer is connected to this global information resource. All right, so I wanted to frame that basic point, because that basic point is the shape of my entire argument that I'm about to make, in that we have certain expectations for devices which are conditioned by the way these devices are presented to us, by the capabilities they're presenting to us. So, another one of the devices that presents capabilities to us is this thing. Now, second survey question. If a couple of you could tell me how many of you had a mobile phone by the time you were 15, hands. So most of you. All right, how many of you had a mobile phone by the time you were 10? So not so many, all right. And that would have been 96. And by 96, about, I think, 50% of Australians had a mobile phone. It was about when they crossed the threshold. And of course, it would have been ridiculous to give a 10-year-old a mobile phone in 1996. In 2006, is it considered ridiculous to give a 10-year-old a mobile phone? No, it's pretty much bog standard, right? So this technology has sort of slid into our lives since the web has. Now, what do we do with mobile phones? All right. What I want to sort of show you is that as a methodology for examining what a technology is, what you do is you actually look at how people use it. So I can look at a technology like the personal computer and say, well, it's really all about the web because that's what everyone does when they sit down in front of it. What thing do you do more often than anything else with your mobile phone? Anyone? That's right. All right. It's very funny now, as you can probably tell from my outrageous accent, I'm an American. All right. Americans do not text. Still, in 2006, they do not text. The reasons for this are poorly understood. It may have something to do with the fact that it costs more money to text, or used to cost more money to text than to call in America. It may be just that America has such a long history of the phone that the only thing that an American can see when they pick up this device is that it's a device for voice communication. All right. When I got to Australia, the very day I arrived in Sydney, I was trotted out by my friends to the local store and I bought a mobile. All right. Because, you know, you're an Australian, you have to have a mobile. You don't exist without a mobile. And that was great. And on rare occasion, my friends would send me text messages and I would immediately phone them back because that was my appropriate response to dealing with a text message. And it was 2 months between the time that I had my mobile phone and I actually texted somebody back. All right? Forgive me. It was this enormous gap for me as an American with my own expectations about what this device was, all right, to cross. Once I got over it, there was no going back. I was like, oh my God, texting is the best thing since sliced bread. It's something you take completely for granted. For me, it was, wow, this is fantastic, all right? And of course, on my own phone now, I would say probably 90% of the messages that come through that phone are text messages and 10% are voice messages, all right? Often is the day that I won't get a single phone call, but I'll send 10 or 20 text messages all around, as will all of my friends. So, you do know that when the mobile was invented, all right, and SMS was invented, that there was no sense that SMS was going to be used for anything particular, right? SMS was invented as a way for the mobile carrier to send out an emergency message to all of its subscribers. All right, so that if there was a natural disaster or if there was going to be a service interruption or, you know, whatever it might be, the mobile carrier could send out a short message, service message to all the mobiles and they'd all get the message. Well, somewhere along the line, someone said, well, you know, we might want to offer this capability to the users so they can send messages to each other. And again, as what happened with the web, there was a period of time that resembled nothing so much as a bomb going off, because essentially what you have is a whole bunch of people who suddenly clue into the power and the ease of the technology, and everyone starts sending text messages. And now, of course, most of the mobile carriers make as much, if not more, money off of text messaging, which is an accident, than they do off of voice messaging. All right. Before SMS took off, when someone looked at this, they looked at this as a device for voice communication. All right. You don't really look at this as, okay, yeah, of course you can talk on it, but you look at this as a way of staying in touch with your friends and your family with text messages. That's the way I look at this. And the thing that I delight in doing is I can use this to send text messages to my friends in America, and it still freaks them out. Now, so this device isn't necessarily one thing or another thing. It's conditioned by the expectations we bring to it. And that's a very big point, because from my point of view, from the research that I've been doing, we have really underestimated what this is. Now, this is a relatively brand new mobile phone. This is 6 months old now, which means, of course, it's completely obsolete. But at the time when I bought it, it was top of the line. And, you know, it's got a nice big, you know, chip in it that can do all sorts of things. It's not 3G, it's still 2G. But it's got a lot of power in it, and so it can do, you know, the phone calls, it can do the SMS, it can play games, it can get online, blah, 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 blah. Great. Wonderful. Now, but what are we using our mobiles for? Are we really using our mobiles very often to get online? I mean, I do occasionally use it to get online. But no, we're still using our mobiles to SMS and to call. Now, why is that? Well, it's because this is a device that's all about communication, right? Communication is all about reinforcing the web of social contacts that each of us carries around inside of us. I want to show you a little picture. So there's an emerging field of research called social networks. Social networks comes from anthropology, in that it talks about the way communities talk to each other. So if you think about your circle of friends and family and how you're connected with them and how they're then connected to other people and how they're then connected to other people and so on and so forth. There's this law called the 6 degrees of separation, which is that you're separated from any other person on the planet by 5 other intermediates. Okay, so that's one of the rules of social networks. Another one of the rules is a rule called the Dunbar limit, which is that in any human community, doesn't matter whether you're in the Amazon or you're in Sydney, the number of people that you have in your social network is never more than 150, no matter what. There's no magic behind it. It has to do with how much gray matter we have. Apparently, the chimpanzees, they don't have quite as much gray matter. They can manage about 30. Orangutans can manage about 20. All right, human beings can manage about 150. Now, thinking about that, and this is a map of a social network in a high school, and the different classes are arranged in different colors, so blues, greens, yellows, first year, second year, third year, so on and so forth, and there are lines drawn indicating all the connections in the social network, so you get this little cloud. And physicists have found this really interesting because apparently this looks a lot like atoms bouncing around, and the way atoms intersect. So the physicists are actually throwing a lot of math at this right now because this has become a very interesting thing. Now, there are social network websites, you've probably heard of them, like Friendster and the Facebook, and I don't know what do college students in Australia use, because the Facebook is American uni students. So what do uni students in Australia use for social networks? Anything? Yeah, so they haven't really, I don't think anyone's sort of dropped a uni student social network into Australia yet. It's something that they're going to tell you, this is so great. Uni students in America use the Facebook to get laid. We've got to be absolutely clear about that, all right? This is how you sort of find the person you're going to seduce and then go after that person. which is why I'm sure that when they come to Australia, they'll be as popular as they are in America. Now, you could, if I give you a piece of paper and said, okay, I want you to write out who's in your social network, you'd think a little bit, and you'd probably be able to come up with 20, 30, 40 names, and these would be the people you'd be in your social network, and I'd remind you to put your family in there because your family are immediately in your social network, and so that might be another 20, 30, 40 people, whatever it might be. And so you'd come up with a piece of paper that might have about 80 or 90 names on it, and you think, okay, that's probably about right for my social network. Now, there's a much easier way for you and I both to know who's in your social network, because that information already exists. If I were to take a look at your call log and your SMS log on your mobile phone, that would tell me who you care about, right? It would tell me how much you care about them, because I'd be able to tell how long you talk to them or how many times you SMS them. So this device that you're walking around with in your pocket is already keeping a perfect record of your social network. But are we doing anything with this information? No. All right, why? It's because we don't conceive of this device as anything than something that we text with and something that we talk with. All right, so what I've been running around promoting as an idea and something that I've been working on because I can write code for these things and I do, is that the next transformation that this device is going to make from a voice device to a text device is that this is going to become the little external part of you that helps you manage your social network. All right? For example, when I was in high school, for the first time they started allowing us to use calculators to do trigonometry. It was considered a very big deal. You could put down the slide rules. Now, I've never really used a slide rule because my class was the first year that they allowed you to use calculators. Do any of you, you've all seen slide rules? Okay, so you know that in theory they exist, right? But when you took trigonometry, let's say, they let you use a calculator because there it is. So, in a similar way, God, I don't even know where the hell I was going with that, but we'll come right back. Okay. That's right, I know where I was going with it. So, the calculator has become this external thing that allows us to do math that otherwise we had to use a lot of log tables and all sorts of fancy stuff for, all right? So it became a way of externalizing a little bit of our brain to be able to do math. The mobile phone's about to become a little bit of a way that we externalize our brain to handle our social life. All right? Because it already is doing that, but it's doing it poorly because no one's really designed it to do that. All right? We have all these sort of ad hoc ways of doing it. If you think about this now, how many times have you been engaged in an SMS conversation with multiple people at once? It's hard, but you do it. You know, you're trying to coordinate with two or three friends if you're all going out, so there are a bunch of messages bouncing around here and there and there. And it's messy, but it works. Now, in Japan, they found, particularly with the younger set, people 15, 16 years old, that there's a phenomenon called co-presence, which is that these kids will spend, from the moment pretty much they wake up in the morning to the moment that they go to sleep at night, in continuous SMS conversation with five or four other friends. All right? Now, it's not so much that they're detailing every single moment of their day, but it's that they've sort of got this cloud around them of the other people that they're connected with. And these people aren't next door to them. These people are maybe across Tokyo or even across Japan. But at the same time, they're constantly sort of just reaching out, touching, exchanging information with these people. All right? The fact that the kids are doing this, even though it's really hard with the current interfaces on mobile phones to do that, to manage five different conversations at once, means that this is something that is trying to pull itself out of the way we want to use the device. All right? You can always tell where the device is and where the ways we use the technology are going based on the ways that people will bend the technology. All right, because it's very hard to make the technology do that right now. But what these kids want is they want their mobile phones to actually manage all of that for them. They want to be able to have access to those five immediately close friends at the touch of a button and be able to fire off a message to any of them so they can maintain that constant sense of co-presence from the morning they wake up, from the time they wake up in the morning to the time they go to bed at night. So, what exactly is that world going to look like that I'm talking about? And I've done some research in here, and I'll sort of show you what I'm talking about. Now, the first thing I did now, how many of you in this room have mobile phones on your person right now? Okay. What's wrong with you? Oh my God, it's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I have to scream weirdly now and throw you out of the room. Okay, so almost all of you have mobile phones right now. They're all turned off because it's a lecture, or are they? How many of you just have them silenced? How many of you have them turned off? You can reach, man. All right. So, do you all know what Bluetooth is? All right. It's a way for phones to send files around the phones or the computers. And the interesting thing about Bluetooth is a really, really cool, wonderful technology. And it's kind of evil. Let me explain why it's kind of evil. When you have Bluetooth turned on your phone, it makes your phone visible on this little network. And the network only goes around 10 meters. So wherever you go, there's like this 10-meter little cone around you of things that you can see with Bluetooth and things that can see you with Bluetooth. All right? And that cone travels with you everywhere your phone goes. So as you walk through the world, you've sort of got this little radius around you, 10 meters in every direction. And as you run into things and they're Bluetooth aware, your phone's aware of that. So what's really interesting about this is that if your phone spends its time not just doing what it does most of the time, it's basically sitting around with its thumb up its butt. This is really all phones do most of the time. But if it's actually listening very intently as you walk around all day, what it's going to hear is it's going to hear you being around some people, say, at 8:30 in the morning when you're sitting on the platform at Central Station. All right, when there are a lot of other phones around. And then it's going to hear maybe not so much as you're taking the train to work in the morning. And maybe it's going to hear a little bit more when you get off the platform. And then when you walk into the office,
particularly if you have a lot of Bluetooth devices in the office like I do, you're going to hear a little bit more. Now, this was a little tool that I made for my mobile phone that just allowed my mobile phone to listen to what was going on in that 10 meters around me. And that was the beginning of an experiment. But the next place that I'm going in that experiment is to say, okay, I can sort of listen to what's around me. Now, what I should do is actually ask the computer to draw some inferences from that. For example, Wednesday mornings, 9 a.m., my phone is going to be able to hear Lossie's phone, Bridget's phone, and so on and so forth, and it's probably going to do that. If I were in this class every day and they were in this class every day, my phone, the computer really, because the phone's just not quite that bright, would be able to figure out that there's some regularity to that, all right? And it probably also, because I would see Ross socially, also figure out that Ross and I associate outside of school, outside of 9 to 5 hours, and we'll be able to understand that there's a relationship between us that extends beyond a purely professional relationship. In other words, if my phone listens hard enough to where I am when, because all my other friends have their phones on, and they're also listening, my phone can gather enough information to understand what my social network is without me having to tell it. Because I already am telling it, because I'm walking around the world. All right? It's a very different way of thinking about what a mobile phone is. We think of a mobile phone as something that is passive until we make a call or get a call, until we make a text or get a text. Otherwise, they just sort of sit in our pockets like pieces of crap. All right? This phone has more computer power in it than any phone I owned, any computer I owned before 1997. Okay? And this phone is getting faster, way faster than computers are. So, you know, by 4 years from now, 5 years from now, the phones are going to be as capable as the computers that we have today. And yet, the only things we really insist on doing with them are make calls and send texts. So, we have these incredibly powerful devices, and we're incredibly underutilizing them. Well, I'm doing my best to try to change the way we think about why we underutilize them. So, what I think is going to happen, what I'm going to try to make happen, and I have some really sort of, my grad student cooked up these pictures for me, is something that's going to look like this, so that if I'm not making a call or sending a text, rather than just having a pretty picture on the phone or some background screen, the phone's actually going to show me context based on where I am and who's around me and what time of day it is. All right? So the phone is always going to be presenting me information about what's going on in my social life and how that's relevant to where I am right now based on the fact of what's going on around me. All right? So the phone is always trying to help. It won't necessarily do a perfect job. It's a computer. It's stupid. But that's okay. All it has to do is try. And in all of that trying, at least some of the time, it's going to be really helpful. Now, one of the most interesting areas where it's going to be really helpful is that one of the things that my phone can do, and a lot of other phones can do now, is they can record sound. Right? And this is something that the phone can simply do in the background. And I've got a lot of storage memory on that phone, so it's going to say that out loud. Right now, in fact, it's recording this lecture so that I can podcast this later. And one of the things that I should be able to do then, if my phone is just always sort of listen in the background, I get home at night, it talks to my computer, they sync up with each other, but my phone also remembers who I was talking to when. So one of the things that I should be able to do later on in the day, as I should be able to go back, here we are, and I should be able to play back any conversation I had during the day, and I should be able to know who I was having that conversation with. All right? Really simple. All of the technology for that is already in place. All that it's going to take is it's going to take us rethinking what we're doing with that technology. Now, of course, there are privacy issues with all of this. But it's not my problem. Now, I have to get to my
let's kill Caesar part of the talk. Okay, let me talk about the cell phone carriers. We all have carriers. You have Telstra, or you have Vodafone, or you have Orange, or you have Three, so on and so forth. Okay, let me take an informal poll. Who loves their mobile carrier? Okay, so you do. You actually have this intensely emotional relationship where they've been really good to you. So, do you love your mobile carrier?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, so there you go. So it's saving you money. Okay. I use Vodafone as my mobile carrier, and the first phone that I bought through Vodafone was the model before this one, and I was really excited because you could play MP3 files. I could put MP3 files on there via Bluetooth, and I created the best ringtone. I was really excited. Black Sabbath. Okay. I created a Black Sabbath ringtone, and I downloaded it to the phone, and I was all set to try to, okay, wait, let's make this the ringtone, and it wouldn't. Not because the phone couldn't, all right, but because Vodafone had Sony specifically disabled the feature on that phone that would let an arbitrary MP3 file become the ringtone, all right? I own the Black Sabbath album. I bought it twice, as a matter of fact, once on vinyl and once on CD. And here I was going, and it turns out, it was because the operating system of the phone had been specifically designed by Vodafone to forbid that, because Vodafone didn't want me using a ringtone on my phone unless I paid them for it. Doesn't matter that I own the music. No. Because what are they doing? They're trying to earn more money. They aren't satisfied with the amount of money that they get from me, and they get a lot of money from me every month because I have the huge OCAP, because I want to be able to use the phone however I want. They weren't satisfied with that. They were really trying to squeeze me dry. And in order to do that, they literally had to break my phone. Now, why is this? It's because the carriers, as economic entities, are not satisfied with the fact that they send the bits of your conversations or the bits of your SMSs from point A to point B. It's not good enough for them. All right? They feel that because they own the network, they have a right to determine what you can do with that network. All right? This is the equivalent, mind you, of Microsoft or Dell or Big Pond saying, well, because you get your service from us, there are certain things we're not going to let you do. And one of them is we're not going to let you download music unless it comes from us. All right? How long do you think that would last if you were an internet provider? It would last about half a second. Okay? Why? Because there are other places that you can go and you can get this service. However, because there are a limited number of phone carriers, and because when you buy a phone from Vodafone, you don't have to buy a phone from Vodafone, but when you buy a phone through Vodafone, it comes with these features turned off. The only way you can turn these features on is to either hack your phone, which I wasn't prepared to do, or to go get a non-Vodafone branded phone. And guess what? This is a non-Vodafone branded phone, because I wasn't going to make the same mistake twice. Now, in America, one of the carriers broke the phone so that you couldn't send a picture that you'd taken with a phone to a friend via Bluetooth, via GPRS, whatever, as an email message. In fact, the only way you could do it is if you had to upload the phone, the picture to the carrier, which they charged you for, and then you could download it from them. All right? Why? Because the carriers believe that they've got us all by the proverbial short and curlies. But here's the thing. It isn't as true as they'd like to believe. We think of the mobile phone as having more or less one network connection. It has a connection to the GSM, GPRS network, right? But this phone right here has three different network connections. It's got the GSM, GPRS, so that's the regular phone network. It's got Bluetooth, and it's got infrared. Not that anyone ever really uses the infrared for anything. And the phones that come after this will have all this, plus they'll have Wi-Fi in them.
right? And you can already get a couple of high-end phones that have Wi-Fi in them. All right, so when I have Wi-Fi on my phone, and I have my hotspot at home or my hotspot at school, why the hell am I going to use the carrier to carry my traffic? The only time I'll use the carrier is if I'm out of doors and away from a hotspot, all right? Carriers are aware of this. They're scared to death of this because they understand that as that happens, and they're really trying to make the handset manufacturers not put this in their phones. The handset manufacturers know what you know, which is that you would get away from the carrier as quickly as you could if you could do it. So the way we use this and the way that this connects to the network is changing. And it's changing because the carriers have done everything they can to close down the way we use these devices. Not a single carrier has tried to be open about it. Not a single carrier has encouraged people to experiment and to play and to change the way we use these devices in order to open up a possibility for the things that can happen. So, like Marcus Brutus, now, of course, Caesar, because his family was the victor, gets a very good write-up in history, all right? We think of Caesar as sort of being the founder of Rome, and that the fact that he got assassinated was probably not a good thing. Not true. Caesar was the first modern military dictator. He set the frame, all right, for Napoleon, for Hitler, for Franco. He is the archetype. So Brutus and Cassius were doing something that was extremely revolutionary, but also, in their eyes, extremely necessary. But of course, history is written by the victors. Octavian, Augustus, and Mark Antony won the war, and therefore, we had then 400 years of military dictatorship in Rome, followed by the Dark Ages, followed then by more unpleasant things in Europe. So, you can strike a blow. Part of what I want us to see, want us to rethink about the way we use mobile phones is that we aren't dependent on the carriers, all right? We're dependent on the carriers if we're out in the middle of the field, fine, they're providing signals running through the air, I'm willing to pay for the service then. But if I'm in this room, or if I'm hanging out with my friends, there's no reason for me to talk to the carriers. So one of the things that I'm working on as part of all this other software is something that I'm hoping I'll be able to release June-ish, and will hopefully be really evil, and that's this. When you try to use a data service on your phone, your carrier charges you. They charge you either per minute, which is what Vodafone does, or per bit, which I think is what Telstra does. And it can get very expensive if you start using data services on your phone. But you also have Bluetooth on your phone. The problem is that the Bluetooth on your phone doesn't connect to the internet yet. All right? What I'll do is write a little program that will run on a Macintosh and on a PC, and if your phone is close enough to one of them, your phone will send the data traffic to your PC, which is connected with a much lower cost connection. And so they can have a nice conversation among themselves, and your carrier is left out of the loop, so that if you're in a room that's got Bluetooth capability, and 5 million Bluetooth devices a week are being sold right now, so almost all modern laptops have Bluetooth in them. It's just pretty much standard. And almost all of those are always connected to some sort of internet connection because a computer without web access is a brick. That then allows us to start using these mobile phones for all sorts of services that we couldn't have before, such as maintaining and exploring our social networks. So hopefully, at the end of all of that, we will have transformed the way that we see the mobile phone. But when we look at the mobile phone, it isn't just a voice device as it is in America. It isn't just a voice and text device as it is here in Australia, but it's a device for us to explore the connections that make us part of a community. That's it. Thank you.